what are your particular interests in regards to where society is going? And, you know, I know it's a huge question to ask, but I, you know, I'm not even necessarily talking about politically here. I'm talking about kind of stuff that interests you philosophically, personal growth, the struggle with making an income, you know, pursuing your own kind of needs as a sovereign person in society. Where are you at on that map?
You know, we're a first world country with a third world memory, you know. So, you know, I come from a background that's, you know, very honest but humble working class background, but my parents still working in, factory jobs in down in Shannon, County Clare. But before that, they were born in households in the west of Ireland. And, you know, the stories our parents always tell us is a bit like Monty Python's, you know. So I grew up definitely with those stories. But I definitely remember, you know, my granduncle and my grandparents and so on, and going out there to houses without, you know, without flushing toilets and shit like that, you know. We have that in our memory, and we kind of forgot that in recent times, right? So there's something going on there. So if you're asking me what's on my mind at the moment, it's a need and a yearning to feel more of that peasant, okay? To find spaces in my life to go basic, to find clearings. I studied philosophy in college, so I loved Heidegger's a dubious character, so maybe my moral ambiguity is coming out here, because Heidegger was a German existential philosopher, happened to also be a Nazi, but he had some beautiful concepts. Sadly, you know, it's such a great shame, you know. But one of them was the clearing, you know, and it's basically about, in the modern world, you need to find that clearing. You need that space for authenticity. And I think we grew up in a world with more clearings, you know. That would be a concern. I think my physical impression of that clearing was last weekend going to Oscar Square. We had a great time, and I played touch rugby with my son, who's 4, and my daughter Emma learned how to skate, and my dad was up. But it was all within an incredibly confined space, you know. And I've chosen to live in the city, and I love the city, so I need to make my peace with this. But I had more clearings in every level from what they have now. And I think that includes the internet and the exposure that is happening with that, in terms of, I guess, you know, the kind of clearing that children need to have before they're exposed to that stuff. And I'm very concerned about that. That would be a big theme. Another thing that's on my mind is, as well, for various personal reasons, you know, family tragedies and things that are going on, the tension that goes on between, you know, again, that peasant memory, growing up in a very Orthodox Catholic kind of household, being an altar boy, turning away from all that, but not feeling it's cool to be slagging people off who are into that, you know. And I was actually talking to a creative the other night, and she just mentioned she was doing something with her church, and I was grateful that she actually said it to me, but it struck me that, why am I grateful? I'm grateful because it's probably unusual for someone to be this confident to say, you know, I'm in a church, like, you know. But it was just interesting that I had a twinge of, oh my God, someone's told me they're spending a weekend with people in the church, you know. But I do have that need, and the yearning is there. And so, again, having studied philosophy, which is, I think, is an absolutely phenomenal support to me, and I think I wish that, you know, our kids were given philosophy as a module in school, or that wasted year, the transition year, or we used to do civics in school. I don't know if you ever did that. And all we ever did was sit around, teacher nearly fell asleep, we were throwing stuff at each other, you know, so we weren't learning about civics anyway. But I think philosophy is a great resource, and I am an advocate of Stoicism. And Stoicism has many forms, but I think it's mainly about the art of life, and about managing your reaction, I suppose, and your response to what Epictetus calls the impressions. So the impressions are the perceptions that you have of what's going on around you. And it's really about taking control of those impressions. And it flourished in ancient Greece. It really flourished in ancient Rome. I think it works very well today because they were often affluent societies, preoccupied with busy lives. So Stoicism is a kind of a release valve from a busy life. It has meditation techniques, for example. It's about taking stock and stepping back. So I would have a daily practice that I would pursue in relation to that. But, you know, meditation is a bit of a rage at the moment. But these meditative arts come from cultural wellspring, you know, which is mm-hmm. religious. And I'll say one last thing. I met a guy from Clare, John O'Donoghue, who famously wrote Anamkara, you know, and he was a former priest, monk, studied philosophy. I met him in college in Galway. He died sadly a few years ago. You know, I think Anamkara is actually a beautiful book because it's very much draws on Heidegger and Celtic spirituality and something that in Ireland we have there, okay? We had that, or we have those clearings, and he was very focused on that. And he just had a point that he made about the rage for New Age spiritual. He hated the word spirituality in the sense it's been
mysticism.
Used. Yeah. And he just was puzzled by, I guess, he was shocked, I guess, by the fact, because he had left the priesthood, that the church squandered its right to claim that clearing, that space, that it had lost or squandered that through getting too messed up in temporal affairs or whatever. And then on the other side, I suppose he finds it upsetting that so many people in this country are seeking for spiritual fulfillment and are jumping on whatever fad that comes their way, yet there was 2,500 years of tradition on the doorstep. But it's not their fault that it wasn't packaged for them or made for them in the right way. It's a strong point to have made, I think, you know, that there was a huge amount of meaning in, and by the way, Stoicism itself, and that tradition of meditation and austerity and, you know, small things like fasting so that you learn about what your body's about, you know. Now, for me, it's actually so that I can eat more pizza at the weekend. But fasting every now and then, a couple of days a week, is a really interesting experience in a world of plenty.
In tune with what you're saying, because I went from rejecting mainstream authoritarian culture, as you know, that was kind of a shift in my consciousness, really. I felt a glitch in the matrix, to use that metaphor, and a splinter in the mind, whatever. I knew something wasn't right, and I didn't have the map to navigate through that until I started to, as you said, quieten my mind and just step away from engaging with corporate culture, mainstream, status quo, whatever. And then I started to kind of rebuild my understanding of reality through observation and through critical thinking and learning about critical thinking and what it means to construct a coherent argument and to understand, you know, the grammar, logic and rhetoric part of the topic and all that. But simultaneously, I had kind of rejected my conventional Catholic upbringing to the point where I became an atheist. And I've kind of come out the other side in that I've had a new appreciation, let's say, for the deep mystical aspect of reality, which lies in the face of objectivism and the Ayn Rand kind of rejecting mysticism, and that everything is based in five sense reality. And if it's not logical and empirical and rational, therefore it doesn't exist. And I don't know, I've just had a kind of a reawakening about that is one part of the Trinity. You know, if you look at the kind of esoteric, symbolic Trinity where you've got the mind, body and spirit, the mind is very important, but mm-hmm. it is one component. It's not the only component. And the concept of the heart and care and compassion and empathy, and then the will, which is the thing that enacts positive change. And that, for me, was a reconnection with my spiritual core, my mm-hmm. authentic self. And in recent months, I've just had a kind of a different understanding of what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'm really, really, like, exceptionally proud to be Irish, because we have this massive tradition and culture and, I think, a genuine connection with the landscape, this deep spiritual appreciation for the land we come from. And I believe in sacred sites, right? Mm-hmm. Places that, you know, the alignment of the way the earth moves, the axis of the sun, and something happens there. There is some kind of alchemical, magical process that resonates positive energy. And I had rejected all that. I said, that's all hocus pocus bullshit, right? It isn't. It's real, okay? And there are loads of people who know this shit, and they're just getting on with it. And they're not, they don't care. They don't care if it's not cool. They don't care if it, because religion, I think, just jumps on top of all that shit and mm-hmm. makes a lot of noise and just directs you away from the real stuff, right? And so I'm a massive fan of Stoicism. I'm a massive fan of the kind of mystic path, which is, you know, quietening the mind, yeah. understanding that, look, there's a lot more going on in this world than we think there is, and that it's really a journey of discovery. And if you're constantly distracted with technology and work and life and that, you don't get the chance to engage with that, you know? And I reject eye culture, right, as I call it. I hate smartphones, yeah. okay? They, for me, represent corporate mm-hmm. culture to distract you from being conscious, okay?
Where I'd agree with you, and I think what's been helpful in this conversation is we've come closer, I think, in terms of being aligned, is that I think we need that, and kind of, and I would use enlightenment more in the Western philosophical sense of, we had an enlightenment within which we had to deal with social change, particularly produced by technology, the printing press, mm. that, and also a post-religious challenge to come up with systems of being and reason and understanding that would make us civilized, like things like the social contract and things like that. And I think there's a huge disruptive change going on. Like, I don't just think this, we all know this, right? It's a huge disruptive change going on. And where I think a lot of this stuff we're talking about, like the need for some sort of clearing, as I'm calling it, I don't want to call spirituality, and I'm comfortable with that, and I'm uncomfortable always. Calling it religion either. That need for a clearing is a response to the age we live in.
Yeah.
It's a response to having a smartphone and be highly dependent, nay, addicted to it. You know, I'm not a pure stoic sitting in his... you know, in my shed or something, you know, I play Xbox, you know, every now and then to unwind, like Frank Underwood or something in House of Cards, you know, I you know, do things that I kind of go against that. It's almost like it's a palliative rather than I haven't adopted the way of life yet, but maybe as you get older, one would, you know. But I definitely feel we need to have some sort of resistance to what's happening and some sort of, as you say, consciousness of it and an enlightenment around it, because it's not all good. I don't buy the Silicon Valley ideology and this kind of technological guruism that's going on right now, that everything's going to be sorted and solved by technology and instrumental solutions. I just don't believe that. But also remember what we were talking about earlier about Adam Smith and the peasant memory. You know, I'd rather live in an era like I'm going to the dentist tomorrow, where the dentist is telling me about the progress they've made in this particular treatment I'm getting, you know. I think we can't have it all and have the benefits. Sorry, we can't be cherry-picking the benefits without realizing that the entire system creates those benefits. The challenge for us, though, is to shape it more and to be more conscious of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And that's why I like these trends in advertising that started this conversation. And I also like Stoicism, because it's about choosing not to be enslaved by these things. I have various Stoic sayings that I read over and over, and but one of the great papers or essays, I think of it as a paper nearly, as a, you know, a memo, from Seneca, right? Mm-hmm. Who was a great, I like Seneca because Seneca's not perfect. Like Seneca, you know, kind of worked for Nero and had loads of moral crises in his career and tried to sway Nero and failed. And also was, you know, on one hand talking a lot about self-discipline, but, you know, had loads of villas and stuff like this, you know. So I like him because I think he's not perfect, you know, and I'm not perfect, and I think a lot of people aren't. But we need to at least go toward the light in some way in our lives. And he wrote a beautiful letter called, he tended to write letters to people. And these letters went on forever, but they're so beautifully written. Any of us would be just so delighted to get them today. Imagine getting something like this in the post. And it was called, it's On the Shortness of Life, you know. And he talks about time as so precious and so important, and in such eloquent ways that I'm not even going to try and ruin now, that all you can think of when you're reading this letter is your own use of time and the way time is being devalued. It's almost like there's an idea like inflation now, and that time is suddenly less valuable because of the era that we live in. And what he reminds you of is through various examples about how it's the most, you know, precious commodity to all, particularly because it's how you invest in it that it comes back and it becomes more. And the reason I'm thinking of that is, again, in our personal lives, as we get older, we encounter situations that demand of us a response that isn't just, you know, I can be an atheist and it's that easy, because there's other things going on in your life, like important things. But I also think your children, right? So contact with your children And their amazing capacity of for wonder and wanting to protect that opens your eyes a lot more, you know, to the shortness of life. In the sense of not, the point of the letter, by the way, is not to go, life is short, you know.
Yeah.
Or that, you know, or to be kind of brutally stoic, we're all going to die, which is, by the way, a meditation that you do. You think about actively about your death every day. But they do it to release the wonder that you're not dead, you know. And I think children, my kids do that to me. And if I allow them in, which is a crucial point, almost on a daily level. But the problem is we don't allow them in because we're all too fucking busy and we're looking at our smartphones. So in a way, you're pushing an open door, but I would not be able to provide for them without it. And it's an interesting...
Well, I think it's a unique dilemma in the modern era, in that, you know, the kind of inherent, oh, I would use the word natural desire to connect with our surroundings, our fellow man, form relationships, ask questions, and that takes time. That you have to invest in that. And if you're running around trying to keep the hamster wheel rotating, you're in this compromise position. You're trying to service both, and, you know, I have to go and this is the clock and blah, 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 you know. So it's unique, and I think, you know, you've just got to make your own version of that and maybe prioritize certain aspects of your day. And you know, you can't be sitting around all day.
The fundamental stoic point is almost like there are two circles, right? There's an inner circle called your control, and there's an outer circle, which are the impressions of the things you don't control. And the impressions are things like eating that chocolate bar that's in the fridge and feeling guilty about it afterwards. You know, your control circle didn't encompass the impression. The impression won, you know? And the fundamental point would be, don't blame the iPhone. As you said, the idiots, you're giving away your life. I fully agree with that, but they don't have to. And they can live with the iPhone and the iWorld and iCulture and reap its benefits and rewards and not allow themselves to be captured. But what's interesting at the moment is there is an ideology, there is a pervasive sort of pop cultural agreement that one should lie over and embrace all of this stuff without any kind of contemplation. And I think that is probably what we're talking about. Where I differ from you is I think we can and should enforce an enlightenment that lives with these things and makes them better and you know, takes some more, increases that circle of control.
Challenges that I have as a conscious man is trying to integrate that discernment into my day to day, and I've always had a sense that this is the righteous path to quieten the mind and to include contemplation and reflectiveness and observation into your day, not always be participating all the time, you know. So I find that a struggle, particularly with three kids. But what I love, and it's, you know, something that I get really annoyed but also super animated about, is that passing on that baton to my kids and to the next generation and speaking this truth to them and trying to instill a sense of the world isn't what we're told it is through, you know, corporate news, media, culture, iCulture, whatever. And I feel really excited that, and I'm tasked as a guardian for my kids to cultivate the sense that, look, the world is full of amazing, you know, stuff. There's just so much. Any day can just produce the most amazing experience, but it also has downside as well. And I love that challenge as a father and as a man to kind of go, okay, I need to up my game. I'm not just going to repeat the old tropes of this is what my parents did and this is what society does and therefore we have to follow that path. I'm sticking my hand up saying no. Okay, and if that isolates me from my social circle, then fine, I'm prepared to accept that. But the basis for my kind of position is one of just asking questions, like, you know, are we generally happier in society? Do we have more authentic experiences? Are we really connected with our families, friends, environment, right? And I would have to say no. Well, now, individually, there are millions of people who are, but...
What I love about philosophy, yeah, particularly the life philosophers, like there's a technical strain philosophy that I did in college that, you know, was quite linguistic and stuff like that, but there's a life philosophy that becomes more important as you get older, and Michel de Montaigne, the French philosopher of the 16th century, wrote essays in his tower and so on, and he used to summon the philosophers too. Now, I don't have his imagination, so yeah, I don't see them actually in my room, like, and they're chatting away, yeah, to me. But he, obviously, they learnt as well. They relied on memory more then and stuff like that. But he wrote some amazing essays. But a lot of, you know, he talks a lot about this sense of having philosophy almost like a habit of bringing other times into your life because, you know, we don't know it all. And also the same shit keeps happening, you know? The same complaints, the same issues. I'm not connected to my family and I'm losing touch with what really matters. And eternally, the greatest tragedy of all, dying with regrets and deep regrets because they didn't invest their time where they should have done. So I think that's an important...
Just
dying well is what philosophy is about. Well, and also recovering the past and bringing that, the idea that there were other times and eras where people...
One of the things that philosophy has enabled me to understand is the concept of self-actualization and know thyself. And if everyone knew themselves, then we would be aware of our environment, of the impact we have on each other, and also having a kind of a deep psychological understanding of what motivates us, what makes us behave certain ways, and in understanding certain kind of universal truths. You know, I'm in complete agreement with you. I think if... And this is something I am going to do. I don't care if it's not taught in school. I'm just going to do it anyway, is to teach my kids the concept of knowing yourself and going through all the various categories. And that's, you know, emotionally, physically, mm-hmm, you know, spiritually, yeah, and then, like, you know, teasing out the concepts and trying to try them on for a while. You know, sometimes I kind of go, okay, what if this was a certain way and would I be comfortable with that? And I think you're right. Certain things just keep coming back to this central path of, you know, self-awareness. You know, the word self is sometimes regarded as, oh, you're selfish and, you know, it's very narcissistic. I don't think that at all. That's the kind of a misunderstanding of what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a deeper self-awareness, raising your consciousness, including kind of contemplation, discernment, reflection, communication, all of these things into your daily life so that as you scale that up then, right, we don't need then somebody to look after us, right? And this is another thing that is a new insight for me is the concept of sovereignty, right? And that we have outsourced our sovereignty to a third party to manage us because we're incapable of looking after ourselves. And I would wager that if you and me, let's say you and me are having this conversation here, I'd be confident that you're not going to try and steal my stuff and try and kill me. We could differ philosophically and we could have fun differing, but you respect my property rights, I'll respect your property rights, and then, you know, we can get on with our lives. So why does that break down once we start to scale it up? This is why I have trouble with conventional authority, because it's a complete lack of a philosophical understanding of how we operate as human beings. We shouldn't need one. So that's the challenge for me as a man and as a parent, is bringing a kid up in a world where it's just authority and rules and that it's, you know, the social contract and this is what we do. Why? Yeah. We should accept that. We should reject that. I think it's a slow change that will occur generations after generations. But I want to be one of the first people who actively kind of preaches philosophical anarchy. And what I mean by anarchy, I mean is rejecting the concept of being ruled. I want to be free.
Isn't it incredible though how quickly the baser brutality comes out when the legitimate authority is taken away? Because I think legitimacy is an important component here. I think the problem we all have with our third party dominating at the moment is that we don't feel it has legitimacy. We don't support it. But one of my favorite books is The Road, which you've probably read or seen the movie of. But the novel is the most profound novel I've ever read. And it encompasses all these things. It's a father and a child. So it's deeply powerful about the sacrifices a father will make for a child, about sheltering them from exposure to the horrors of the world around them, making him feel that he has a destiny and a positive role to play into the future. You know, they're going on this horrible road all the way to the sea, you know. It's so, such a frightening book as well, like, you know. It's the apocalypse. Who knows what the fuck's happened? Some sort of... We all imagine what happened, right? And there's, you know, horrible, horrible human beings around that he has to protect them from. It's such a profound book, it's hard to sum it up. But I think there's part of that fable is what happens when we take away the legitimate authorities that we need, I guess, at times.
Yeah, and I find this conversation quite frustrating because sometimes I think I'm not communicating it sufficiently.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about the absence of rules. I'm not talking about the absence of guardians of the peace. I'm not talking about...
If you don't mind me asking, it sounds to me you're talking about a bit like our Stoic conversation. It's about what kind of attitude or reflexivity you bring to those rules.
Mm-hmm.
So a bit like the iPhone being... an extension of power, I think, from the Apple Corporation through the various outposts that they have, like General Petraeus had in Iraq, the Apple stores, and, you know, through the media, oh, Steve, and everybody worshipping at this kind of icon's feet and so on. That's an exercise of soft power, I guess, you know? And it's the, I think what your point, which is really well made, is to, why do we not question these sources of authority? Having a questioning energy and being reflexive about what's going on is probably what's the great missing element.
Yeah, I think the missing element for me as well is people trying to understand the concept that things will only be okay if somebody else fixes them, where I now understand that you need to fix yourself first before society gets fixed, okay? And that you're tasked with sorting your own shit out and doing the hard time, self-examination. And I'm not talking about going to see a shrink or anything. I'm talking about, you know, the philosophical coach where...
Yeah.
And that, you know, it takes time, right? And that it should be part of your day-to-day. It's not something you just do and put aside and go, okay, that's done now. It's a constant journey. It's part of your everyday, your waking experience, your integration and your experience on a day-to-day basis and that.
You know, there's a philosopher, Michel Foucault, you might know, and he talked about power, and in particular, he was more up to date on how this concept worked. But a key part of what power does is it creates what he called docile bodies, you know? And there are techniques of power. So a lot of the debate will be, well, were they bloody techniques or did they just happen? But ultimately, it's a technique of power that we become self-focused, we switch off from social functioning. The care of the self becomes a preoccupation. And particularly in our age, the care of the self is probably not as high-minded as what you and I talk about with stoicism and establishing a clearing and making our children realize that there's more to the authorities in life and so on. I think we're talking about something deeper, but however, taking care of oneself, being self-focused, is a brilliant technique. If one was an imaginary, all-knowing, all-powerful dictator, what a brilliant system to bring in that everybody would be obsessed with themselves and spend all of their time taking care of themselves, whether or not that was high-minded or not.
Yeah, see, I think that's not where I'm coming from. That's the start of it, is that just turning the focus inward, you know?
Yeah.
It's an inward journey as opposed to, I'm all right, Jack, screw everyone else. Part of that realization is that you're a part of the universe and that everything, you know, there's a cause and effect, and that, you know, what you do to yourself affects what you do to others, you know? That's a deeper philosophical understanding, you know? So it's not about, I look after myself, screw everyone else. It's, I look after myself, everyone else benefits, right? That's kind of where
That's good, anyway, I like it, yeah. I think we should develop this.
We should develop this, so we'll leave it there for the moment.
Leave it there.